This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levac. Of course, many people on both the left and right tired of government gridlock. But about a week ago, that gridlock became very real for thousands of West Texans. The government shutdown that began on October 1st means that many are furloughed, but many more federal employees deemed necessary are still on the job but don't know when they will be paid. With thousands of federal employees at Dyess Air Force Base, TSA agents at major West Texas airports not knowing when their next paycheck will land, a couple of entities have reached out with offers to help. Brad Majors is a senior vice president with First Financial Bank. He joins us right now to talk about some of the response locally to those impacted by the shutdown. Brad, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here.
Before we get into that need and the current situation, this isn't the first time that First Financial has been faced with this kind of situation and federal employees. That shutdown happened in 2018, and it lasted, if I remember correctly, about a month. Do you remember going through that a few years back?
Yeah, I do remember that. Very similar program to what we have now as far as helping out those people in that time. And like I mentioned earlier when we were talking off air, you know, we've had other instances with Hurricane Katrina, the West Texas wildfire as we had out here, you know, other disasters that have hit other parts of the state where we have banks at. And so, you know, we've always have, you know, done the best we can to try and help those people when those situations come up. And so this is kind of very much along the same line as those previous situations.
It's interesting that you're mentioning two, you know, basically tragedies or disasters. And I think for those families that are affected without possibly getting a paycheck for a while, this may feel like a man-made disaster for some of them. Back in 2018, do you remember any instances of people saying, we need help?
There were a few. You know, having the, of course, the Dyess Air Force Base here, we do, you know, get many customers that are, you know, either related to or in that job description there. So there were a few. Thankfully, you know, with it roughly being a month, it wasn't, you know, something like along COVID where people were maybe worried about getting no checks for 6 months or something like that along those lines. But there were a few that and that had that situation come up, and we were happy to help them as well. Yeah.
So many employees in West Texas affected, and it's not like many of them can go find a job elsewhere. They're being told to work. They just might not get a paycheck. What kind of services are you guys offering to help them maybe get a helping hand through this?
Right. Okay. So we've got three-prong approach that we're doing, that we're taking to this. And so I'll kind of hit each one here. So, and this is primarily going to be for like your consumer customer. So we're not talking about maybe a commercial borrower, for instance. But so the first thing is we're offering payment deferrals. And so this is going to be for an existing consumer loan customer that has maybe a car loan or a boat, motorcycle, anything, a non-commercial related loan with us. And so we're offering a payment deferral, which is in essence is where, you know, we can skip the current month's payment coming up. We just have to collect a little bit of the interest that's due, and then we'll roll the principal to the back end of the note for them. There's no charge to do this. Very simple to do. I just encourage those folks to reach out to their loan officer, and then they can handle it from there for them. Very easy.
Is there something they need to do to maybe prove they're a federal employee or that somehow the furloughs are affecting them?
Really, we're kind of taking a no questions asked deal. As long as, you know, you are an employee of the federal government and not receiving a paycheck, you know, we'll be more than happy to help. So pretty simple.
And you said there were a couple of more components to this help.
Yeah. So also, if you have a real estate loan with us, with one caveat, we can do a deferral as well on like a real estate note. We will defer the principal and the interest, but we do have to, if you have what's called escrow, meaning your insurance and your taxes are attached to your payment, we do still collect for those because we got to make sure that those are current whenever those come due down the road. So we'll do those for customers as well. Now, the one caveat is if it's a home equity loan. If it's a home equity loan, there's some rules with the state that don't allow balloon payments at the end of the home equity note that we got to be very careful about whenever it comes to doing a deferral on one of those. So if you have a question about that, I would encourage you just to reach out to your loan officer specifically, and we can address that more specifically there.
Brad, And I realize you're not speaking for every bank or every entity in the United States. You're speaking for your bank, First Financial. But what if somebody has maybe their auto loan is with First Financial, but their house is somewhere else? Would you encourage them to reach out to their lender during this time?
I would. Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially if it's a local lender or a credit union where you have a direct connection, I'm sure it's a little bit easier than connecting with maybe one of those larger banks that they don't necessarily have a direct relationship. But yeah, if you're having an instance where, you know, it could affect your credit or you're worried about making a payment, I would definitely reach out to your bank and see if they can assist in any way. Yeah.
There's issues, obviously, with employees. For instance, somebody who is at the Air Force Base working in the military, but federal contractors, too. You know, they're being told that maybe they're not getting the receipts they were getting to pay their employees. Those employees are furloughed. Are you hearing from that, too? Because we have a lot of contractors at military bases all across West Texas.
Right. I haven't yet. Now, it doesn't mean that I won't, you know, have a contract employee come in and ask for assistance or any sort of questions about that. But it definitely, you know, if we do have a relationship with someone in that instance, I'm sure we'd do what we can to help them out. Yeah.
No one knows how long this federal shutdown is going to last. You're hearing things. Maybe it's just to scare us that this could be a long one. Mm-hmm. Are you guys prepared to help these guys through the long haul?
If we have to, yeah. I mean, we did the same thing through COVID. You know, we were one of the leading banks in the doing those PPP loans you probably heard about.
Sure.
You know, I myself processed almost 100 of those for different businesses around Texas. And so, yeah, we're prepared to do whatever we need to help these folks. You know, and from our perspective, if, you know, it does the bank no good to not help these customers because, you know, it hurts both parties. So we're going to do what we can to help these individuals and make sure they get by as well, too. So,
what other kind of services are you offering for your customers?
So the second of the three things we were offering also is a short-term bridge loan, which is almost like a little personal loan for maybe a month's worth of expenses or something like that to get people through. Now, it's subject to credit approval, so you have to qualify for the loan from a credit perspective and everything. I think we'll go up to roughly twice your monthly gross income, but the customer can stretch it out over a 3-year, 36-month period to get them some kind of cash up front in order to kind of help them get by for, hopefully, knock on wood, this short-term no government shutdown. So we're offering that as well, too. It's also a below market interest rate. So if the customer or someone's interested in that, just have them reach out to one of our lenders, and we'll be happy to go into more detail about that. And the third one is we also are offering NSF refunds. So if we have a government worker that's had some overdraws in their account because of not getting a paycheck, we'll refund. I believe it's up to 10 NSF charges in a month for a customer or something like that were to happen.
Brad, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. Appreciate you guys. Appreciate everything ACU does in the community as well, too. Y'all are a great partner with us as well.
Brad Majors is the Senior Vice President at First Financial Bank in Abilene, Texas. Thank you for the kind words. The bank has reached out to customers affected by the federal government shutdown and offered to help them through this tough time. And we should note, First Financial is a supporter of KACU. Stay with us. After the break, we'll take a look at how local educators are engaging their students, staff, and community partners in the effort to help families affected by the shutdown. This is the West Texas Dispatch. We heard about how a local bank is making sure folks who rely on their work at Dyess Air Force Base can navigate that government shutdown. Local schools are also organizing support. Abilene ISD is taking several steps aimed at helping families affected by the shutdown. KCU's Heather Claiborne spoke with Superintendent John Kuhn about their efforts.
Both Wiley and Abilene School District serve families with connections to Dyess Air Force Base. Superintendent Kuhn, when did the district begin to recognize the need to organize support for these families?
I think it wasn't long after we heard that the shutdown was actually happening. I was actually out at Dyess and in a conversation with our liaison between the school district and Dyess Military Base, learned that in the case of a shutdown that our uniformed personnel actually continue to work for no pay. We have over 1,000 students whose parents work there at Dyess, so we were aware that there would be, you know, potentially a need for some support.
And it's not just the uniform personnel, but there are lots of families whose parents are contractors or have other related businesses. So, I mean, do you have a sense of what that impact might look like?
What I learned from the liaison that we work with was that uniformed personnel continue to work for no pay, and that many of the contracted personnel are just kind of simply furloughed and told not to come into work until the shutdown ends. And so, yeah, we definitely have concerns about how these families are going to make ends meet until the shutdown is over. And of course, we have no idea how long that might last. So our hope is it doesn't last very long, but we didn't want to waste any time trying to do what we can to help. You know, it's not a lot, but hopefully we can support in a few ways.
So these families did get their paychecks last week. It'll be a little while before they may feel the impact. Some of them won't see a paycheck next week. What is the district's approach to supporting these kids and their families?
Well, it started with just a group text message where we kind of brainstormed some solutions. We partner with Love and Care Ministries and the AISD Homeless Liaison to provide meals on the weekends for a lot of our students who may have the financial need. And so the first suggestion was, I wonder if our partners with Care Packs for Kids could maybe expand that effort to incorporate some of these families. And, you know, that took a little bit of organization because they have funders for the students that are already being served, but we're talking about adding potentially, you know, a number of new students to that. So step one was basically to try and find funders for that. We can't spend, you know, taxpayer dollars on something like that. So we have to find partners. You know, funding has already been secured to expand that program. We don't have any idea how many families potentially might need to be added to our roster of kids, basically getting these care packs to take home. And those packs are easy to prepare, healthy food options for students to take home and have snacks both for Saturday and Sunday. So that was the first idea that we had. And then the second idea was to ask our students to participate in some fundraisers, and those funds could go directly to things that exist on base to support families of military personnel that may have financial struggles, right? So we thought, well, maybe we could, you know, ask our students and our staff to contribute to those type of missions or ministries or programs. And so we have several things going on right now. Ward Elementary, the first week that we did this, they raised $658 by giving kids the option to wear a hat to school and bring a stuffed animal for a dollar. And so they had a lot of kids participate in that, and that money will go straight to the charitable organizations that work there at Dias. We also have Dias Elementary doing a change drive, asking kids to bring, you know, change that they might find in their home or in their vehicle and donate that. We have Cooper High School starting something called Dollars for Dias, where in third period, if a student has a dollar bill or a $2 bill, to donate that, and the winning class that brings the most money will get a donut party. And then we have several campuses that they didn't want to ask the students to contribute because maybe they have they serve a higher percentage of low-income students. So those campuses are asking staff members to donate or giving them the opportunity to donate. So we have a lot of like fun things going on at our campuses to just give our students and staff the opportunity to show AISD's support for our neighbors at Dias Air Force Base.
You mentioned that you were able to find partners to help cover the costs of expanding the Care Pack program. How did you find partners, and who are they?
The Abilene Education Foundation kind of took the ball and ran with it. The only thing I did was I put out one Facebook post when we first started planning this to basically give out the word that, hey, we're looking at doing some things. And I did have a response on Facebook from the local HEB basically saying, hey, we're in. But Abilene Education Foundation is a, you know, nonprofit that is really good about reaching out to the community to meet different needs that come up. So they've been working on that. My understanding is they've had some partners step up, but I couldn't tell you exactly who those are.
Is there anything else that the community should know about how the shutdown is impacting your district or the families that you guys serve?
Well, like you said a moment ago, you know, it's kind of a slow impact to actually feel it, right? Because there was a paycheck that was still to come. And I do want to say that one thing I learned through this process, too, is that most of the time after a shutdown ends, a lot of those employees or all of those employees will get back pay for what they missed during that time. But our thought was, well, yeah, but between now and then, we don't want any of our kids to go hungry or any of our families to struggle anymore if it can be avoided, right? And I want to say also, you know, kind of a shout out to Wiley ISD. I saw Cameron Wiley, one of their board members, posted something for his community listing some of the ways that folks can help and some of the different avenues there on the base that are available for these families as well. So I think, you know, Abilene as a whole community supports Dias, and I'm just happy that Abilene ISD could be a part of that. You know, even if this is a short-lived shutdown, and even if there's no real financial hardship that comes up for these families because it doesn't last very long, still, you know, the ability to show that we care is important to me. I think we're all in this together as a community, and these folks out at Dias who serve our country and keep us safe. And I think it's a privilege to be able to say, hey, we have your back. And I think not only Abilene ISD, Wiley ISD, and I love to be a part of a community where we care for each other and we take care of each other. And it's just a privilege for Abilene ISD to be able to just say, hey, we're willing to help. And we have children giving pennies and nickels and dimes, and it's not much, but it does give our students the ability to say, hey, I care about what happens with these families too, and I'm a part of this community. So I think it's also a learning opportunity and a teaching opportunity to help develop that sense of community and, you know, that civic pride and just being a good person.
Well, Superintendent Kuhn, thank you for serving these families beyond the end of the school day, and I wish you well with all these efforts.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you talking to us.
That was KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Abilene ISD Superintendent John Kuhn. The district is organizing support for families impacted by the shutdown of the federal government. More information is on AISD's website and social media. It's an exciting time for youth sports in Abilene. A new development promises to change the future of youth athletics for the better. Here's KACU's Josiah Wannell with more.
For the last 5 years, the Donch Jones Youth Sports Center has hosted hundreds of sporting events, but all were inside. That is no longer the case with the Abilene Youth Sports Authority's newest venture. The ROC, short for the Recreation Outdoor Complex, opened this fall aiming to give more local kids and families the space to play, compete, and connect. For Brandon Osborne, the executive director at the Abilene Youth Sports Authority, that was the whole point.
One of the visions that we've always had at AYSA is to try to have opportunities for kids to come play, be in a safe, clean, excellent, but then also try to teach the values of Christ through the sport and try to impact coaches, parents, and players through that.
The fight to make the ROC a reality demonstrates one of the key lessons coaches try to instill in their players, determination. The outdoor expansion is the latest phase of a project that didn't gain traction early on. 20 years ago, when the Abilene Youth Sports Authority first pitched the plan and a more than $17 million bond, it didn't get onto the ballot. In 2008, voters rejected a plan to spend $15 million on the project. Supporters were finally able to pick up steam through public-private partnerships, with the City of Abilene offering a deal on the property and helping cover some of the infrastructure, and private donations covering construction of the indoor facility. In 2023, they finally broke ground on the outdoor fields. Now 10 new fields, 4 with turf, 6 with grass, all outside, are open for business.
Indoors is basketball and volleyball and pickleball, and now outdoors will be football, soccer, ultimate frisbee, rugby, all the outdoor, anything outdoor. We want to try to impact every kid in their specific line of interest in terms of sports.
Even the complex itself was designed with busy families in mind. At the center sits a spacious clubhouse where Osborne says parents and siblings can rest and watch the games, rain or shine.
Then we also have what we think is a separator is the clubhouse that sits in the middle. And their clubhouse has offices as well as meeting spaces, as well as like a loungy area for parents and like a kid's indoor play area.
Osborne says they developed the spaces for fans with practical concerns in mind, as many parents juggle cheering on one child while caring for another.
And so the clubhouse allows for both of those to occur. So they can theoretically be in our clubhouse while at the same time watch their kids play in a climate-controlled environment versus having their kids out in the elements.
Local resident Kenneth Isabor says the ROC is a welcome option for families who want a safe, reliable place to play.
I think it probably helped for, you know, feeding into school programs. It's a bit more safer places to do events instead of just the parks we have, so that's neat.
AYSA wants families near and far to find this venture to be an attractive option. Brennan Osborne says they hope creating such a well-planned facility will help make the ROC a regional youth sports destination.
We want to try to draw some of the surrounding larger cities like the Lubbocks, Midlands, Odessa, San Angelos, and also involve some of our smaller communities so they can compete against the bigger communities as well.
Backers of this project have touted the economic benefits, saying it saves the team's money and brings in extra dollars to the local economy from visiting teams. According to the Abilene Convention and Visitors Bureau, visitors spend on an average of $200 per day per athlete. The AYSA projects the facility will generate more than $250 million over the next decade. The complex isn't completely finished, but Osborne says activities are already in full swing. Teams began with soccer and flag football just before the grand opening. More sports, including spring leagues and tournaments, are around the corner.
We're going to start a lot of different activities. I mean, we'll have spring soccer that will kick off. Different groups that want to come in and do ultimate frisbee. We're going to try to work on a grass volleyball tournament.
It's not just ultimate frisbee or grass volleyball either. Organizers are wide open to hosting sports that aren't as common in West Texas, like rugby and lacrosse, maybe even Quidditch. Now that it's built, they expect all kinds of sports fans to come. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
The National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association holds a handful of competitions throughout the fall season. Last weekend, teams from, well, several regional colleges competed in Abilene, Texas. Teams facing off in a variety of roping, racing, riding events. The next NIRA competition will bring the college rodeo event back to Angelo State University. And for the first time in a few decades, Casey Sisk is the coach of the rodeo team there, and he joins us to talk about the season. Casey, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this Angelo State rodeo team first. Where are some of the strengths that you can think of with this team?
Well, you know, we're still a fairly new team. This is our second year, but our third rodeo season, and we started this team with six athletes, and now we've grown to 35, and we've got a really good team this year, so I'm really excited about the future.
How do you explain that, going from 6 to 35? Is that a lot of recruitment, or is it, reputation?
Yes, sir. Well, recruitment, and, you know, it's something that's still new. It's a new program, and I think that some of these kids want to be a part of the legacy that we're going to leave at the end of it, and I think it was just a new opportunity, and, I mean, Angelo's cowboy country, rodeo country anyway, so it just kind of fits right in with what we're doing.
Good central location in Texas as well.
Yes.
I mean, just pretty much dead center. Well,
yes.
Your second year, third year, I guess, possibly, because you guys did a competition before that. So talk about it. Why did you want to bite off something so big as putting on your own rodeo?
Well, it's a lot of work, but I think to bring back a college rodeo to Angelo is just – ties it in with, and we're going to tie it in with the Central Open Fiesta. We've got a really good partnership with them guys and Stock Show and Rodeo. And I think it's just going to all feather right in, and it'll bring a little bit more rodeo to Angelo, which we've got plenty, but you can never have enough rodeo.
Well, that was my next question for you, Casey, is, you know, fans of rodeo know what to expect when they hit the Coliseum and watch some national tour. This is different. This is college rodeo. What are they going to see that's different from maybe a typical Friday night?
So you'll get to see, you know, we've got the ladies goat tying, which they don't have during the pro rodeo. But for the most part, it's all the same events. We'll just have the goat tying, but you just get to see it at a collegiate level. And you know, a lot of these kids already have their PRCA cards bought. So it's just, you know, college is kind of a stepping stone for some into the PRCA. And it's just, yeah, you just kind of get your feet wet and you get to be in one of the toughest regions there is.
Is there a crowd favorite event that you can think of?
Oh, I think everybody likes the bull riding. But I think for our college rodeo here, you know, we're going to keep it the same as the Fiesta. The score is, the calves are going to be scored out longer. The goat time is going to be a little bit longer field to run down. So it's, yeah, we're trying to keep the tradition of the Fiesta here in our college rodeo as well. And I think that's something that's pretty neat that we can do.
Casey, how many colleges are going to be competing at the Angelo event?
We'll have 7 colleges.
Wow.
Yes, sir. Yep, 7 colleges.
Well, are there some specific events that you look at your team and go, you know what, we're going to be pretty good at that? Is there something that you're looking forward to seeing, thinking that you might do well in?
Oh, yes, sir. Yeah, I mean, I think we're pretty stacked in most of the events, the tie-down roping, the breakaway, team roping, steer roping, goat tying. I mean, we've got players in pretty much every event, so there's a pretty good shot for everybody.
Well, Casey, I was going to ask you what you're doing to prepare, but literally right before our conversation, I know that you guys were moving dirt out there and you're taking a break from that right now. Sounds like a lot of work goes into this kind of thing.
It does. It does. And, you know, they rebuilt the Fiesta Arena. So they've been really getting after it over there, and we've got a really nice facility, and we're just trying to get the finishing touches done before we can get in there and have our rodeo.
Are there challenges with this being the first time that you guys have hosted? And well, again, yeah. In many decades.
Yes, sir. Yeah. It's just, you know, we used to be a part of the Southwest region, which was one of the biggest regions in the nation. And we split in June. So we've had since about the end of June to figure out how we're going to get this rodeo thrown together. And there's been a lot of people involved to make it move. And we're really grateful to have that.
Casey, I think people understand how a college football game works and what's next. Can you explain to us how this works? Do they move on from here? Are there some kind of playoffs? You mentioned the PRCA.
Mm-hmm. So we have a total of 10 rodeos between the fall and spring semesters. So we go 5-5. And then the top three in each event from this region will go on to Casper, Wyoming, to the college national finals. And that's where we will crown the national champions.
So you're all aiming for Casper, to be frank.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's my main goal.
NIRA, Lone Star Regional Rodeo, will be this weekend. It's in Weatherford. Angelo State will be hosting that rodeo. That's October 23rd through the 25th, with the season wrapping up in Vernon in November. And we leave you with some thoughts from Glenn Dromgoole.
Maybe this can't be proven scientifically, but I suspect that more people in small towns than in large ones, and especially in the South, were called by their first and middle names when I was growing up. Among the girls in our town were Mary Ann, Mary Sue, Mary Jane, Mary Frances, Mary Lou, and Mary Alice. Linda Sue, Donna Sue, Bonnie Sue, Carol Sue, Sammy Sue, Billy Sue. Linda Kay, Winnie Kay, Linda Ray, Johnny Ray. I knew a Bobby Wayne, Bobby Joe, Joe Bob, Joe Don, Billy Joe, Billy Bob, Billy Glenn, Billy John. James Lee, Ray Lee, Roy Lynn, Roy Lee, and Leroy. Joe Neal, Joanne, Joe Carroll, Sarah Joe, Nita Lou, Linda Lou, Betty Lou. Lou Ann, Betty Ann, Beth Ann, Barbara Ann, Cheryl Ann, Carol Ann. Carol Jean, Barbara Jean, Carol May, Annie May, Letty May. The Bells and Nells, Lula Bell, Annie Bell, Bertha Bell, Olga Nell, Adrian Nell, Bertie Nell. And Frank Stanley, Minnie Lee, Martha Fay, Phil Malois, and even a Dinky Ruth. Of course, nearly all of us have middle names, but most don't have to go by them. About the only time most people get called by their first and middle names is when their mother's mad at them. Maybe I'm just more sensitive to being called by first and middle name because growing up, I was Glenn Allen. This is Glenn Allen Dromgoole for the West Texas Dispatch.
Glenn is the writer of some 35 books and runs the Texas Star Trading Company with his wife, Carrie.
This is West Texas Roots on West Texas Dispatch. I'm Alexis Jones. This week, we talked to Tara Reich about her role in the schools around the big country and how the Abilene community comes together to support children's access to basic necessities and education. Abilene is not a town that is designed for you to be isolated. You can, if isolation is your thing, you can thrive in the solitude. But Abilene has a lot of magic and events and connection points and just love that you will find and get immersed in if you can find connection points. And so I learned that pretty early on and made efforts to find my people here and get exposed to what makes Abilene different than anywhere else. I was very honored and blessed to be able to stay home with my children for a few years. And then once they were all in elementary school, I re-entered the workforce and then had to revisit how to be socially acceptable. And that kind of leads me to here. So I work for Communities and Schools of the Big Country. Communities and Schools is a national organization, and we are a local affiliate within that. And our mission is to surround students with support to empower them to achieve in life. We want to intervene and give them the tools to be successful beyond high school. And we meet all kinds of needs. And that can look like academic support, mental behavioral health support, basic needs, clothing, food insecurities. What we do is very deep and wide. And so it's kind of hard to wrap up exactly targeted what we do, but we are just there on campus. We have staff on campus during school hours, supporting students and their families however we can. And I work in the admin office, the central office here in town, and I do our marketing, our fundraising, and just general campus support. And that's been really, really fun. It allows me to network with people that want to support students outside of our organization and figure out how to give them opportunities and avenues to support and interact with our mission. And then I also get to support our staff and kind of be on the front lines of what those needs look like and what we can do to address them. So one of the things that I do is I also do a little bit of fundraising for our program. And last year, I had this idea for a fundraiser, and our group has never done a local fundraiser. I went through a couple of different ideas and then landed on one that I thought was unique and interesting, and it's a rucking event. It's essentially wearing a weighted pack or a weighted vest and walking. That's literally it. And it's adopted from a lot of military first responder type physical activities. It's designed so that you can carry weight for a long period of time. And so I thought rucking in relationship with our mission was a good fit because the weight can symbolize the weight that children carry on campus every day. So I came up with this idea at Carry for the Kids. And last year was year one, and we are coming up on year two in December. But I just got so much joy from kind of pulling on a lot of different levers to get this event up and running, using it to support such a big cause. The funds that are raised go to address things like basic needs. So the focus for this for me is clothing, food insecurities, hygiene. That's another big need is hygiene. And then for people to come out and have a good time was just a huge joy, because leading up to it, the night before going, what if no one comes? What if you put in all this work and you've told all these people, you've hyped it up, and you show up at 6 a.m. and nobody's there? But people did come, and they endured, and they had a great time. And I just felt so much also pride in our community for showing up and supporting. And we're doing it again, December 6th at 8 a.m. Registration's open.
Hey friends, before we go today, we want to remind you that we're looking for the greatest ghost stories of West Texas. Is there a whispered rumor about the abandoned house on your street? Have you experienced the unexplainable? If it gives you the chills, we want to hear about it. Tell us your West Texas ghost stories by emailing us, westtexasroots@kacu.org. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Recently famed singer-songwriter and former member of the Crickets, Sonny Curtis, died after a sudden illness. KTTZ reporter Samantha Larned spoke with the West Texans who knew him and has more on Curtis's life and his legacy.
Born in 1937 at the end of the Dust Bowl, Sonny Curtis grew up on his parents' cotton farm in Meta, Texas, less than 30 miles southwest of Lubbock.
Working the cotton fields, driving tractor all day, and having time to think about writing songs. I mean, what are you going to do when you drive a tractor half a mile that way, half a mile this way, back and forth all day long?
That's Jacqueline Bober, the City of Lubbock's Municipal Museums Director. In her role with the Buddy Holly Center, she met Curtis a number of times and has studied the Crickets' careers. She says Curtis started playing music and writing songs at a young age. His uncles, who together formed the bluegrass band the Mayfield Brothers, taught him to play guitar, banjo, and fiddle. He and his brothers Pete and Dean created their own bluegrass trio, playing county fairs, radio stations, and small stages in the area. Andy Wilkinson is an area writer and performer, as well as an admirer and friend of Sonny Curtis. He says Curtis would hitchhike from Meta to Lubbock to play with other musicians.
And that's where he got to meet Buddy and J.I. and Joe B. and the folks who would be the Crickets.
Curtis expanded his musical range through his collaborations with others, like Buddy Holly. Bober says Curtis and Holly bonded over their appreciation for music that was harder to come by in Lubbock at the time, such as rhythm and blues.
Come midnight, they would have to go out to the car and turn the car radio on to listen to some shows that come out of Louisiana, Mississippi, that would play that type of music and just listen to it till they fell asleep because it was so wonderful.
Curtis, Holly, and fellow musicians like Bob Montgomery and Don Guess were soon recruited to open for artists like Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley.
That even further broadened their horizons into this new genre of developing music that we call rock and roll.
Curtis stepped away from the group to tour with country star Slim Whitman. He rejoined the group under the name The Crickets in 1958. 1 year later, while on his winter dance party tour, Buddy Holly, along with musicians Richie Valens, J.P. Richardson, and pilot Roger Peterson, died in a plane crash. It was at the childhood home of fellow Cricket J.I. Allison that the band learned of Holly's death. They were staying in Lubbock after a recording session in Clovis. According to Sonny Curtis's website, it was in this period that he wrote what he called his most important copyright, I Fought the Law.
That's incredible. You've probably looked up, or if you haven't, you should, all the people who have covered it, you know, from the Clash. I mean, for goodness sakes, for a farm kid from Meadow to have a song covered by the Clash is sort of cosmic.
Others include the Bobby Fuller Four, Grateful Dead, Bruce Springsteen, Green Day, and many more. At 21 years old, Curtis was drafted into the Army and temporarily left the Crickets, but he continued writing music, including Walk Right Back, which was performed by the Everly Brothers. After his service, Curtis rejoined the Crickets, did work writing commercial jingles, and continued to write songs throughout his career. Another one of his most recognizable is Love Is All Around, the theme song to the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
He did that in 1970 and actually fought hard with the producers of that show so that he could sing it.
In his career, Curtis was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Musicians Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame along with the Crickets, and had several songs win awards of their own. Through it all, Wilkinson says Curtis was a mentor and friend to anyone who needed it.
He was the kind of person that would introduce you to people, would tell people to come out and hear you play. He was willing to play on your record. You know, I was a nobody, and he played on my record.
Wilkinson says Curtis had a hopeful and refreshing perspective on a business that's hard to succeed in.
I asked Sonny, I said, you know, because here he is, Sonny Curtis, written all those songs. And I said, what in the world do I have to do? And he said, well, let me tell you, just because I have hit songs doesn't mean they think I'm important. When I walk in that door, I'm no more important than you are. They want to know what I have that minute, and same with you. So you just got to play your songs for everybody that will sit still and listen.
According to Wilkinson, Curtis's kindness and collaboration is reflected in the art scene on the South Plains even today.
The fact is that out on the frontier, you have to rely on people, whether you like them or not, whether you agree with them or not, whether they're the same color, the same ethnicity, the same language, the same politics, the same religion. you have to be neighbors with people. And that neighboring, I think, extends to the arts.
Both Bober and Wilkinson say Curtis is an example and a role model.
He knew something they didn't know, and that was he knew how determined he was to make it.
He's a great songwriter and a great guitar player and a great singer. And to go along with that, he's one of the kindest, nicest human beings on the planet. I've known him for a long time. I've never seen him frown. And there are not many people you can say that about. He was just a gem of a human being, and that made it all the better.
On September 19th, at 88 years old, Curtis died of pneumonia at a hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. His wife and daughter were with him. Curtis's daughter, Sarah Curtis, said on social media that her father lived an exceptional life, one that touched many hearts, continuing, quote, "May we look at his life with joy rather than sadness. He would have wanted that." In Lubbock, I'm Samantha Larned.
Visits to national parks in Texas may find a lack of services in the wake of the government shutdown, but exact details are unknown. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton has more.
Visitors to Texas national parks like Big Bend National Park and the Padre Island National Seashore are likely to encounter a lack of services. According to the National Park Services, both will remain mostly open, but there will be limited or no staffing. Previous shutdowns led to lack of maintenance and a buildup of trash and waste at the sites, and in one instance, vandalism at Big Bend. Websites to all national parks have a message at the top, which links directly to the government shutdown contingency site from the Department of the Interior. The information doesn't shed any light on what services are available at individual parks, but does say open-air areas such as roads, trails, and overlooks will stay accessible, but staffed facilities like visitor centers will close. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. We hope you plan to join us and tell a friend. If your friend isn't able to tune in exactly at noon on Wednesdays, let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our team of producers, Heather Claiborne and Alexis Jones. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.